Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel. The all-new Opel Mokka. With a new visor front face and pure panel interior, this is Opel.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Northern Ireland, its past, present and uncertain future is the subject of a book called Northern Protestants on Shifting Ground. And the author is journalist and writer Susan McKay, and she joins me now. You're very welcome, Susan, and
thanks,
congratulations on your new book. Can we talk about the title, Northern Protestants on Shifting Ground? How is that political ground shifting?
Well, it's actually shifting a great deal more than I had anticipated at the time that I started writing the book. The line comes from the poet Jean Blakeney, who I interviewed in the book, and she was telling me about how she's from the border area in County Fermanagh. Her father was a customs officer, and she talked about how she had felt a sense of panic because she felt the ground shifting in Northern Ireland, and as a unionist, she felt that the voice of her people was being lost.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of chose myself to see on shifting ground as having a potentially positive side, in that things are changing, but they need to change because the North hasn't really properly implemented the Good Friday Agreement. You know, the whole reconciliation part of it is still only being sort of toyed with at the edges, and there's still a huge amount to be done. So I think that there's a lot of settling to be done, but not all of it is as threatening as some unionists are making out at the moment.
I know you want to talk to me about the cover of the book, mm-hmm. and the symbolism of this. Now, people who are watching us on our online feed might be able to see the cover here. I'm holding it up to the camera. Will you just talk us through, for people who are listening, what we're looking at?
Yeah, I really like the cover. It's a photograph by the great Derry photographer Trevor McBride, and it's of the effigy of Robert Lundy, which is burned in Derry, which is where I'm from, every December. And Lundy was the governor of Derry in 1689 at the time of the siege, when the Jacobite Catholic forces were besieging the city, and the apprentice boys, the loyal, staunch Protestant apprentice boys, decided that they were going to hold out. And Lundy thought that there should be a surrender. He thought that the city couldn't withstand a siege. So ever since then, the cry of no surrender has kind of represented the bottom line for unionist politicians, and a Lundy is regarded as a person who is a traitor. But more and more, when I wrote my first book about Northern Protestants in 2000, which was called An Unsettled People, I was afterwards called a Lundy by certain people because they felt that I had been disloyal.
Mm-hmm.
But I discovered in researching both books that it really doesn't take very much to be called a Lundy. You just have to kind of think or imagine things could change. And what I found in writing this book is that more and more people do want to think differently and do want things to change. So therefore, there are a lot of Lundys about, and I feel that I'm in very good company.
Let's talk a little bit about the people that you spoke to and the various themes in the book. And one of them is this disdain for the DUP. It borders on contempt among some of the people that you spoke to. How do you explain that?
Well, it's very strange because a lot of that disdain and contempt is expressed by people who nonetheless vote DUP. So it's hard for people to understand that. But basically what it comes down to is what it has always come down to in Northern Ireland, is that people vote along ethnic lines on the whole. And that hasn't really broken down to a huge extent, although it is breaking down a bit with the rise of the Alliance Party. And the Greens, mm-hmm. and People Before Profit and various other smaller parties. But people vote for the DUP because they see them as being the dominant unionist party, and so therefore if you're pro-union, you will vote for the unionist party. But a lot of people are simply not voting anymore. You know, something like 50% of people don't vote at all,
and you
among
found
the
that
young, it's even higher.
And young women, mm-hmm. young yeah. Protestant women, where they're not voting. In some cases, that's what you discovered.
Yeah, they're not voting, or if they are voting, they're tending to look at Alliance or the Greens, or some will probably now look to the Ulster Unionist Party now that it appears to be taking a more progressive direction. But a lot of them are not voting simply because they are pro-union, but they cannot vote for a party which is anti-gay, which doesn't support same-sex marriage, which doesn't support a woman's right to choose. So they're saying, well, we might be pro-union, but we do have a solidarity with mm-hmm. those who need abortions, those who want to get married, those who are gay. You know, so there are a lot of people who would like to be politically active but aren't finding it within political unionism. But one of the people I interviewed was playwright who talked about how Stacey Graham is a different young loyalist woman, but Stacey talked about how young people now are digital natives, you know, so they're connected in with a much wider range of sources for their imaginations than their parents would have been, or their grandparents certainly, and they're into global movements, you know, like climate justice and feminism, so they're not finding unionist parties in Northern Ireland that give them the opportunity to progress those causes.
Mm-hmm. If a party like that existed, that gave them voice, do you think it would succeed? Or is the sectarian vote so ingrained now that it's almost impossible to change?
Well, I think that the disaster which is currently unfolding within the DUP is going to change a lot, you know, because a lot of people would have, and I would be among them, would have said, you know, that the Ulster Unionist Party was kind of finished, mm-hmm. because it certainly looked that way under its last leader. But if Doug Beattie does succeed in turning that party around, even to some extent, I think that that will make a difference. It's interesting to note that the young loyalist woman, Julianne Corr Johnson, has just announced that she's joining the Ulster Unionist Party. And that is going to make a difference. But I think the commentator, Alex Kane, made a very interesting point about that when he said that if Doug Beattie truly is going to go in that direction, he's going to have to let the party get even smaller before he can grow it again, because there are a lot of conservatives within the Ulster Unionist Party.
So it's going to take political bravery in order to make that shift.
A lot of it, yeah.
And is the idea of a united Ireland catching on amongst Protestants?
Well, that was one of the surprises to me, Claire, was that a lot of people are quite calm about the prospect of a border poll. I could not honestly say that I met anybody among the Protestant community who was wildly enthusiastic about the idea of unity. But there were quite a few people, including people in the DUP, who felt that, well, if we can't make Northern Ireland work, and it's not working particularly well at the moment, it goes from crisis to crisis, then maybe some form of unity wouldn't be the worst thing. And then there are others who don't fear a border poll because they think that the pro-union side would win it. But there isn't the panic about a border poll that I think a lot of people down here might assume there is.
Mm-hmm. We don't often hear that voice, though, do we?
That's the unfortunate thing. I think, unfortunately, you know, political unionism has a tendency to reach for the loyalist paramilitaries as a kind of a warning to everybody if things get tricky politically. And that has happened again. You know, you saw Arlene Foster, the outgoing First Minister, you know, having those meetings with loyalist paramilitary representatives earlier this mm-hmm. year. And now more and more we're hearing from this all-male, previously unheard of group called the Loyalist Communities Council. And they aren't mainstream. They don't represent unionism in working class areas. I myself, if I was going to look for voices in that community, would go for some of the people that I've included in the book, like Eileen Weir, who works in the Shankill Women's Centre, and she says, you know, loyalist working class Protestant women are to the fore, they're miles ahead, they're streets ahead of other people within the community in terms of reconciliation and bringing about change. I mean, there's lots of people in Northern Ireland who are angry, but they're not angry about the protocol. They're angry about things like the fact that there are now dozens of food banks all over the place, that people are really struggling with poverty. They're angry about the lack of women's reproductive rights. All kinds of things like that are exercising people, but we don't hear about those because it's this kind of historic thing of looking at things in terms of the threat of loyalist violence.
And one of the other problems that you deal with in great detail is drug addiction. So there is mm-hmm. a prevalence in some places of heroin and cocaine, the availability and then the addiction that happens subsequently. These are in places where those drugs were not available or used in the past. What has happened?
Well, heroin isn't a huge problem in the North compared within the Republic, say, and that's because, as one person put it to me, the business model simply doesn't work because a lot of people who start taking heroin die and therefore...
The income stream is gone.
Yeah, whereas within loyalist communities, what you're seeing is a very strong trade in cocaine, because what they do is they get young people, they sell it to young people, they allow young people to get into debt with them, and then they start saying, well, sure, you can work for us and pay off your debt. But of course, as one woman put it to me, that's like offering George Best payment in whiskey. You know, young people are addicted, they're going to be using those drugs themselves, they get deeper and deeper into debt, and then they are then part of the loyalist paramilitary movement. So it's a really, really vicious cycle.
How big is that movement? Loyalist paramilitarism?
Well, it seems to still be. I mean, the BBC did a report recently where they found, I think, something like 12,000 members. But I think it's kind of quite a loose movement. And it is more of a gangster criminal movement now than anything else. I mean, some of the people who have recently been sort of warning us that loyalist paramilitaries are going to take up violence again are very clearly, visibly not in a position to take up violence themselves. They're older men. They don't have access to the weapons. They don't have access to the support of British security services who backed them up before. So I think it's there's no doubt but they could make a very uncomfortable summer. And there's no doubt that that's risky because innocent people can end up getting hurt and killed. But there certainly is not a loyalist paramilitary movement in the north that is ready to sort of take up battle again. And let's face it, loyalist paramilitary battle means killing Catholics. And nothing more than that, really.
Is it wise, though, to simply dismiss those groups as being criminal?
I wouldn't dismiss them as being criminal. I would say that they're a very significant threat as a criminal movement. There are a couple of interviews in the book with women in loyalist areas who have got caught up in having to fight with loyalist paramilitaries because of trying to rescue their sons, essentially. And they're a very, very significant force within those parties and within those areas. And, you know, one woman that I spoke to who didn't want to use her name because she didn't want her windows broken, you know, she was a progressive community worker and she was kind of saying, look, I can't use my name. I'd like to, but I just think my life would be made impossible in this area. So there are ways of intimidating people that don't involve, shooting people. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no doubt but that people could get killed. But I think that to overstress that is to play into the hands of those people. And I certainly wouldn't be dismissive of them.
Yeah.
But I do think they need to be seen in the context of what they have become.
Another element that really struck me from your book was the people you spoke to who have lost relatives during the Troubles. Mm-hmm. And the dead included prison officers and RUC members. And they express this sense of abandonment that they feel in the aftermath. And that sense of abandonment is there for a lifetime in some cases.
Yeah, I did a few interviews with people who were survivors of the conflict. And one of them was with Kyle Black, who's actually a young DUP councillor now and a really, really impressive young man. His father was David Black, who was killed by dissident Republicans relatively recently.
Yeah.
And Kyle was talking about how he really feels that the DUP needs to start reflecting the wider community better, you know, that it needs to sort of expand and realise that people are now more progressive on a lot of social issues. But yes, he talked about that and he talked about the horror of having to drive past the spot on the motorway where his father was murdered and see graffiti there for dissident Republican groups. And, you know, a lot of even Sinn Féin representatives who are not involved with dissident Republicanism, but they've spoken very disrespectfully sometimes of those who were killed by the IRA, who were members of the security forces. There's a need for a huge amount more sensitivity and action in relation to dealing with the issues of legacy. Another couple that I spoke to was Chrissy Quinn and her partner Davey. They're a cross-community couple. And Chrissy's children were killed during the Drumcree protest in Ballymoney. And she talked to me about her surviving son and the difficulties that he has had. And she talked about him being essentially reclusive now, not really able to cope with the fact that his brothers were killed. And I spoke with Alex Bunting, who is one of the injured group. And Alex has had great, great difficulties in getting on with his life after an IRA attack during the Troubles. And he's one of the group who still after years of campaigning and going to the courts and everything, have not yet received the pension to which they're entitled.
And they draw, some of the people you spoke to draw a comparison between how the relatives of those who were killed in Bloody Sunday were treated and the amount of money that were spent on inquiries in the aftermath. And yet they say, don't they, that the British government has done nothing for us British citizens that have lived in hell in the aftermath of killings for 35 years.
Yeah, there is a widespread feeling of that among people who were victims of the IRA. And in particular, I think that's a quote from one of the Veitch sisters whose parents were killed in the Enniskillen bomb. And they feel very angry because they feel that their situation has been ignored. Personally, I think that you have to look at something like the Bloody Sunday inquiry in a different way. But I respect their right to feel aggrieved about the fact that they have not had any proper investigation yet of what happened in the Enniskillen bomb. And to add insult to injury, they haven't been allowed to put up the memorial that they wanted to put up to their dead. The memorial which was put up was always controversial. And I think that there has been a lot of pressure on victims and survivors to go away, you know, to just leave everybody alone. You know, people talk about them dragging things back to the past. But the reality is that legacy is not going to go away. There are too many people out there who are still very, very deeply hurt. And
understandably so.
Very understandably so, yes. Mm-hmm.
So where does all this leave you then? What conclusions did you draw when you came to the end of this exploration of where Northern Protestantism is?
Well, one of the things that I think is hopefully important and useful about the book is that now that there is talk of a border poll, I think that people in the Republic really need to know that there's a very, very diverse community up there of Northern Protestants. It isn't just this kind of monolithic society that people used to identify with Ian Paisley Sr. You know, there are people there who have a very, very wide range of political views, many of whom will need to be understood if there is to be any form of New Ireland that includes the North. And there's going to have to be a lot of generosity and imagination all around. It isn't just a matter of, oh yeah, well, I suppose we'll have to put up with them. Mm-hmm. You know, people are going to need to understand the unionist mentality. They're going to need to understand why people cling to their flags so strongly, and they're going to need to be accommodating.
Well, this is a fascinating insight into all of that. It's called Northern Protestants on Shifting Ground by Susan McKay, and it's published by Blackstaff Press, and it's out now.
Thank you very much,
Susan,
Claire.
Thank you very much. Good to see you. Let's take a break.
Today with Claire Byrne. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player app.